Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You guys, I am so excited. My new course on behavior, the Practical Behavior Approach, is officially done and ready to go. Enrollment is only open until April 30th. And if you are someone who is supporting a child with frequent challenging behaviors, listen in because this course is for you. This course was designed for any teacher, special ed or gen ed, clinician or parent, working with a child with frequent negative behaviors. This course is going to prepare you with a comprehensive toolbox. You're going to have all the tools you need to prevent problem behaviors, respond when problem behaviors happen, and to build those missing skills. We go in depth into why behavior happens, looking at contributing factors like diagnosis, trauma, anxiety, and sensory need. This is truly a cohesive course where strategies are rooted in the science of applied behavior analysis, but also rooted in trauma-informed practices. So you're going to have both perspectives to develop this really robust framework of strategies that is truly going to be effective. So if you are feeling burnt out, overwhelmed, or out of answers on how to support your kids, click on the link in the show notes and learn a little bit more about this course and how the training and all of the downloads and tools are going to really help support you on this journey to helping your child be successful. I can't fully express how excited I am to get this course in your hands. Click on the link in show notes. Let me know if you have any questions. And when you get started, let me know how it goes.
Hi, I'm Sasha Long, special ed teacher and board certified behavior analyst. Welcome to the Autism Helper Podcast. I'm here to explore different strategies to improve the lives of individuals with autism.
Welcome back to the Autism Helper Podcast. I am so excited to share my interview with you today with Dr. Jamie Hughes-Lika. She's a board-certified behavior analyst at the doctoral level with almost 30 years' experience in the field. We cover so much in this episode. I joked at the end that we need like three follow-up episodes because we're covering such a big topic. Today we are discussing NDBIs. We needed a new acronym in our lives, didn't we? Naturalistic Developmental Behavioral Interventions. So Dr. Hughes-Lika will explain in the interview how these strategies have always existed, but they're really this cross connection of applied behavior analysis and developmental psychology. She gives a lot of great examples about how these strategies can be so effective, especially with our young learners, at really teaching these critical, pivotal skills. We are really only scratching the surface of this very important topic and discussion. In the show notes, Jamie made some amazing visuals that really extend on this topic, so I highly recommend you go there. We are also linking some relevant research and articles that you may want to access to follow up on this topic. Jamie is the founder of Sage Learning Systems, where she has several online courses. I'm going to link that in the show notes. And she has a newer membership available for clinicians that are working on the Early Start Denver model and these NDBIs. There's such a need for this in the community. So if you're looking for CEUs and support community on this topic, definitely check that out. But today, let's go ahead and hear from Jamie. Hi, Jamie. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Sasha. Good afternoon. I'm so happy to be here.
I am really excited about this topic and to kind of pick your brain. This is something we haven't talked too much on the podcast about. Today, you're going to introduce us to naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions. It's a mouthful, right?
Yes.
You want to explain what these are?
Yep. I call them NDBIs because it's much easier to get it all out. And they're not new, but categorizing them as this specific type of intervention is. So way back in, ages ago, which I'm going to call 2015, the developers of these several named Interventions wrote this really cool consensus paper, and they said that, you know, these similar approaches, while they're guided by this shared philosophy, are different in their own ways. And that's a Schreibman 2015 article that I'd love to share with the listeners if they're interested. And in that article, they really talk about the theoretical bases for NDBIs. They talk a lot about the empirical support surrounding NDBIs, the different characteristics, and the shared common features. So it's a really good article if you want to learn about NDBIs and this new category of what they are to get into.
Yes, definitely. We will link those in the show notes.
Yeah, and it's great because I know that you've been in the field for a while. I've been in the field for almost 30 years, which is just mind-blowing to me. And in that time, you know, autism intervention has changed significantly. So we think about those highly structured ABA interventions that were, you know, coming back from the 60s, 70s. And then we have this ongoing research that's really kind of moving us towards these more naturalistic interventions that are integrating the ABA principles, our science, with developmental psychology. And that's what NDBIs bring in. We have this naturalistic setting. It's developmentally focused. We have the amazing behavioral ABA type science guiding the strategies that we're using, packed into everyday routines, activities, and play.
So kind of the best of both worlds.
Yes, better together. That's what I always talk about. That's a great way to think about it. And so back in 2015, there was also an article by Zweigenbaum and colleagues, and same thing. Their research is saying that effectively integrating developmental and behavioral interventions is amazing for the 0-3 population, which is where I spend most of my time. So the sooner the better we get in there, we can really try and get these kids support. But doing it with that population, with the little ones, is a little bit different approach than maybe our, for me, an older kiddo would be 4, 5, and 6, which I know is not old. But when you work with infants and toddlers, whoa, those are preschool babies.
So you kind of mentioned this, you know, traditional ABA, like in the 60s. For those that kind of are unfamiliar with the types of strategies that that would entail, can you kind of flesh that out? And then, you know, the next piece, how are these strategies different than that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about some of those more traditional type ABA programs where it's more adult structured, adult led, adult driven, might be some mass trial, you know, quote unquote, drill and kill at the table, if you will. That was a great way. And it's still a great way for some children to learn. They need that structured approach and they're not quite ready to move into the more naturalistic child led. But one of the things that I think is really missing from that is taking into consideration social motivation, kind of what is happening within autism. What are those characteristics? How are we supporting social communication for children? Are we thinking about the social role of imitation? So when we look at NDBIs, we're really looking at this back and forth dyadic engagement where, if you think about it from like a conversation, the child is the speaker, the child is the listener. I'm the speaker, the child is the listener. So it's much more fluid in terms of the flow of what we're doing. The targets that we might select as well are a little bit different. So if we were thinking about education goals for IEPs or intervention or treatment goals for an ABA type program, those are going to look a little bit different too. And so we're really trying to get into what are these foundational, pivotal skills that are going to really maximize and amplify the child's learning. And I think in NDBIs, we do this so, so well. And one of the reasons I think we do that is we think about these cascading effects. And we think about them when we're developing the goals and objectives. So what I mean by that is we're talking about the flow or progression from these lower level skills, kind of prerequisite foundational, all the way up to some higher level language skills. But we also put a really important foundational role there into play because we know that that's going to impact and trickle down, if you will, those developmental outcomes. So joint attention is a great example of this. Imitation, functional communication, shared and reciprocal engagement, that back and forth social dyadic engagement. We need our teachers and our professionals and parents to understand how these skills layer on top of one another. And so that we are not skipping those prerequisite collateral skills, we're not overlooking them. And that way we're really ensuring that the child is ready for everything that's coming at them.
I think that's such an important point, the prerequisites. And I think, honestly, I see this in classrooms a lot.
Yeah.
Teachers that are really struggling with kids, trying to get them to the table and let's do a workbook, let's do worksheets, and they don't have joint attention or they have very little imitation skills. And I'm like, we're not there yet, guys. Like, let's scale back.
Yes. And you have an amazing course on executive functioning for some of our little ones, even at this age and range, we're starting to target these skills where we're coming to get them to a table, but they have issues with transition. There's that attention motivation issue. I talk about it as can't do, won't do. I've talked about it like that forever. Can they do the skills or don't they want to do the skills, right? Motivation is key. So thinking about what do we need to do to condition the table, right? Condition the workbooks, pair it with reinforcement to make it more fun. And within NDBIs, the learning is naturally fun by the way of what we're doing. And it could be a workbook and it could be a puzzle or Play-Doh at a table, right? The difference is that we're trying to really support them with these foundational skills, cascading effects, thinking about all of these really cool strategies that we have that we can unpack a little bit later that are going to really enhance attention and motivation and make it that balanced child-led, child-choice activity. And when you do that, I find that dysregulation decreases, behaviors go away, and you get that maximal, optimal learning, which is what we all really want to strive for.
And it's so much of it is that reinforcement piece. They want to be there. They want to be doing it because it was their idea, which I totally get.
Absolutely. Choice, the power of choice is so important. And I think when we go into learning objectives or thinking about IEP goals a bit more, what we're trying to do with an NDBI is just to really focus on supporting those characteristics or challenges that a lot of our autistic children are experiencing. We want those foundational skills. Again, some of those precursors to language and social attention, joint attention, we want to support them. And that's, I feel like, a little bit different from a more traditional ABA type program. The emphasis on social communication and getting into gesture, social attention, joint attention, imitation, all of that good stuff is so, so key, especially for the little ones.
Yes. And I think too, our older ones that are when I say older, I even think about that 4, 5, 6-year-old that you're talking about that, you know, comes to preschool first time and, you know, is like, hey, I'm here. And then doesn't have those prerequisites too.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Can you talk a little bit, because you mentioned a few times child initiated, and really kind of define what that means? And then my follow-up question to that would be, how can that look in a classroom setting?
Absolutely. Yeah, when I think about some of the myths and misconceptions about NDBIs. So NDBIs are not letting the child have control of everything. They're not just physically following the child around the room and doing whatever the child wants. And they're not imitating, quote unquote, inappropriate behaviors. So those are some things to kind of clear up. What they are, they're grounded by the science of ABA. They're guided by the developmental psychology. They're evidence-based, and they can really easily be integrated into the natural environment. So there's a difference between child-led and child kind of driven, if you will. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about child-led, we're looking at what is that child's spotlight of attention, right? Where are they focusing? How can I join in that spotlight? How can I get them to shift and share that spotlight with me so we can focus on what's motivating to them to capture their interest and get in there with some of that social attention? So we're really trying to maximize attention and motivation to get them to engage with us a bit more. So it might look like that I might follow the child around the room, but I'm not following the child. I'm following the child's attention and motivation so I can become a part of that and engage with them. And through that social engagement is where we're going to get all that amazing learning to happen. There's also balance, there's boundaries, there's guidelines and expectations that we're doing within NDBIs. So sometimes when I hear people talk about, oh, NDBIs or ESDM, it's just child play. Well, we do play because children 0 to 3 typically learn through play. So that is the nature of what we do. But we also embed these into community outings, into everyday routines, self-help skills. So thinking about what children are doing at that age range or even into preschool, they are learning through different types of activities that are functional and, I think more importantly, meaningful for them. And mm-hmm. then we make it fun and we get in there and really try to maximize the learning. So those are things I think that hopefully will help clear up like child-led versus child-run.
Yes.
Yeah. That's and, really you know, you see that.
I think of that misconception of like when we think like, you know, child-initiated and child-led that like, oh, we just let the kids do whatever what they want and then we just sit there. And it's, you know, I think that's good to clarify. That's not what we're talking about here.
Yeah. When we're talking about kind of these child-led sessions, and it's not like 80-50% of the time, it's just back and forth that it ebbs and flows as we work with the children. We're really valuing that connection over compliance. We want to join in with them. We want to expand on their interest, get them interested in what we're trying to do as we embed those learning objectives. And then we're adding that structure and support to their idea to really scaffold it to help them expand on their learning process. And again, there's limits and boundaries, and we share that curiosity and enjoyment with them. And we hope that they also share in ours. So it's this mutual back and forth where it's not always adult directed. I wish I could say it was 50-50, 80-20. It just ebbs and flows like attention and motivation. Everything changes from moment to moment. And so being flexible in our teaching is going to be so helpful. And I giggle when I think about people who aren't flexible because we're trying to get children to be flexible.
So often it's the adults, right, that have the hardest time being flexible.
I have been there myself, yes, and trying to capitalize on that. Sorry, I know you had a second question. Follow up with a second question again.
Yeah, so no, that was really helpful to kind of think through that all. And, you know, when we think child-led, we do often think of play, right? That, like, is first thing that comes to mind, and kids do learn through play. Even our older kids are learning through play. Those are hands-on experiences. And even before I get to my second question, I was thinking as you were talking about, you know, these real life experiences, our daily living skills, community outings, that when we're learning in these real moments, not only is that like natural motivation there, but there's also no need to really so much plan for generalization as much because the generalization's right there. It's already a real world thing. And I think that's a problem with some of our quote unquote old school strategies is that we have to do so much work with generalization because, okay, you learned the color blue sitting at a table with a flashcard. Cool. But like, what are we doing with that? Like, do you know that it's your blue shirt? Do you know you have a blue lunchbox? Can you find the blue dinosaur? And like, if we have to do all of that, then teaching after teaching the blue flashcard, what was the point of teaching the blue flashcard? You know what I mean?
I do. I feel you on a deep, deep level there. And I get flashcards. They're convenient. They're easily accessible. You know, if I want to teach the concept of an elephant, I'm not going to have a zoo by me. I can't go there and get one, but I can get a card. So I understand they're easy to organize, sort, match, all that good stuff you can do with it. But you are absolutely right with the generalization component. when we are teaching in an environment such as life that the child lives in, you're naturally going to have those multiple exemplars around. You're going to have generalization built in just by nature of what it is. And those teaching targets, blue, like you said, are going to be much more meaningful. Get your blue cup. Where's your blue teddy that happens to be the favorite? Mm-hmm. So you can really embed and think about how to support the child with there. And when we talk about the ESDM, Early Start Denver model, where I spend most of my days, we think about kind of a framework for structuring our sessions and our interactions. And that looks like a setup, a theme, some variations, and some closing, transition. And so throughout all of the things that we're teaching, they're embedded within that. And we're layering in, that's the best way to describe it, those learning opportunities. So if a child in a classroom wanted to, I don't know, get bubbles down and play with bubbles, you wouldn't just get the bubbles and open it. You might put them in a place where they're in sight, out of reach, right? Some of these awesome strategies that are going to enhance attention, motivation to maximize communication. So that's an environmental arrangement. But then they bring it down. Maybe it's the child points. We get the chair. The child can gently, with some support, stand up on the chair to reach it. We tap the lid to open it. All of these little layers are getting so much more learning in place for the child, as opposed to, I want bubbles and it opens it and it starts. So you could have 8, 9, 10 steps in your setup and get 10 learning opportunities for 10 different goals before you even get into pull the wand out, start blowing, pop, pop, stomp, stomp, whatever, and then changing up the variation of it. So these joint activity routines, JAR, as we call them, could be a minute, could be 10 minutes. It depends on the activity, it depends on the child. And that's that structure that we really bring in to help support cognitive flexibility. It helps support executive functioning because there is a sequence to the flow of the routine that we're doing. So that could be something we do in play. That could be something getting dressed, brushing your teeth, eating. That same framework is just rinse and repeat across all of these different activities of life to really maximize that learning. I'm going to say that a lot. Maximize the learning. It's so important.
I love it. That was a good example. And to think through what that really looks like and the two kind of different ways of like, oh, here's, I want bubbles, here's your bubbles versus all of those different learning targets that you can embed.
Yeah. So, you know, when we're talking about like a theme, that theme is this conversation. I love to talk about JARs and frameworks as conversations. We say hello, right? That's the greeting. Then we get into a theme. It's the topic that we're going to talk about back and forth with each of us having our own role. I blow the bubbles and you catch them and stomp them, reverse. And then having that variation, sometimes the topic changes. If we talk about the same thing too long, it gets boring. Some people drift off. We don't want to talk anymore. So that variation helps prevent that from becoming boring, keeps it exciting and fun, maximizes attention and motivation. But it also helps support some of that flexibility. I'm doing something different in a different way. Can you roll with that? Mm-hmm. And a lot of our children have a hard time if they get rigid and kind of stuck, have some sticky attention, if you will, of doing something a certain way. Our support for them through the framework is already building that in to make sure that we don't have those issues and that we're targeting them and hitting them kind of head on. And then that closing, we got to shut it down together. We say goodbye. Don't leave me here and ghost me. Walk away. Like in the conversation with me, pick the toys up, put the ball away, close the bubbles, whatever it is that we're doing. Transition to the next thing and support them on that transition, which starts the next conversation or framework, if you will. And that is just over and over and over within the ESDM model, how we do our teaching. Which,
love that.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of group ESDM research out there, how they take this and they implement it into the classroom. Which I think
that was my follow-up question like 10 minutes ago. And I was like, well, wait, let's talk about this. But okay, so we typically, you know, we can think about this in this one-to-one play-based session. Great. This looks awesome. Mm-hmm. A school is by nature, you know, kind of adult-driven, mm-hmm. the culture of a school, right? So how can we pull these strategies into the classroom?
Yep. So we have, again, embedding those learning opportunities. So in the classroom, that's your natural environment right there. You have circle time, group time, small center time, outside recess time. All of those would be activities that you would be embedding the learning opportunities that match up with the benchmarks or the IEP goals that are working on them. And there's, again, different models that have really done well with this. There's classroom pivotal response teaching, CPRT. There's an amazing manual available for that. There's the group ESDM model, another really great manual available if you want to learn how to put this into practice. Those are two commercially available things you can tap into. There's the Walden program. There's early achievements for settings. So there's a bunch of stuff out there that people could look at. Not only are we doing ESDM or NDBI applications in the classroom, there's a lot of literature and data to support that they do work well. So when we think about, again, that structured or predictable environment, which you're going to find in the classroom, I don't see it any different than the planning of what you already do, right? You plan the environment, the schedule, your daily activities. And what we're trying to do is to really emphasize or wedge in there that those activities are meaningful learning experiences. We've got a rich variety of different materials. We're supporting ideas that invite the children to come in and want to learn. We got that active engagement back and forth where it's adult directed because it's a teacher, but there also are opportunities that we're pausing for children to initiate, for children to reciprocate, right? We're trying to build in that relationship and that back and forth dyadic engagement between us. I'm sure there are many teachers that are offering choices, and we want to offer choices that are going to help promote kind of agency. We want advocacy. We want the children to tell us what they want and what they don't want. That's a hot topic right now in the field of ABA, assent and assent withdrawal. Mm-hmm. Looking at all of that. And so it's really important when we think about how to support this. So within the group ESDM model, we have different roles. So there is a support person, there's a float that helps the children transition across the different centers. And we have children that are neurotypical as well, with children with language delays, autism, or other neurodevelopmental differences, and they're supported together. And it's really based on peer models. The peers are modeling things. There's a person to help facilitate whatever it is they're doing, Play-Doh, matching letters, writing, whatever. And so that makes it doable to have this type of support with the teaching framework in a classroom setting. And then there's the key teacher and then some support staff, just like you would have with the helpers or the paraprofessionals. So for that model specifically, it's easy to implement because of the nature of the way the model is set up. We don't always have that one-to-one beautiful teaching, like you said, but also not every child needs that. And if we always give that one-to-one, are we teaching the children to learn from what's going on around them? That's not life, right? Like they have to learn in a small group setting. So I think that's an excellent question of how we can support NDBIs in classroom settings.
And I think that, you know, looking at that group model, so often we have, you know, in early childhood classrooms and in preschool classrooms or special ed classrooms, paraprofessionals that sometimes are one-to-ones or classroom helpers that what are they supposed to do? Like, do I do it for them? Do I help them? But if they have this clearly defined role on how to support these goals, how to integrate peer models, because I often see really hardworking, great paraprofessionals that are like, I don't know what to do. Am I supposed to play with him? Like, you know, what's my role here? And then it can help kind of define what their job is.
Absolutely. And then that would reduce stress and excite them to want to come into work because they have those clear expectations and know what to do. And just like our children like to have, you know, some predictability and clear expectations, they feel comfortable with that. They feel successful with that. So you're still going to have that individualized instruction, but within those small group or centers, right? So you have that person that kind of people are transitioning from group A over to group B. There's a person who literally just kind of directs the traffic, if you will, to move them over. And then the children rotate. And then that helper, that prompt or float, still stays there. So it's really exciting to think about how you could do something like this in a classroom setting and thinking about how you're maximizing the learning by arranging the environment to support what those children's strengths and needs are. So we're going to use that data, you know, from your assessments and your teaching that you're doing to really help tailor those activities and trying to think about what's going to make it meaningful for a child within the context or maybe the constraints of what the teacher has to do in that classroom. So the child is learning regardless of what it is that they're doing. If it's playtime, small group, recess, group instruction, center time, we want them to be working on something that's related to helping support their learning and to get those outcomes where we want them to be. I think the other thing that could be really helpful is trying to foster or facilitate these responsive interactions between the peers and the teachers. So again, we're joining in that child's play and idea. They're joining in with ours, and we have that back and forth reciprocity, not just with adults. We want our children to learn from their peers, right? We want that to have. So what peer confederates might be available that we can match up, and how can they support one another in their learning? So does the teacher have to do everything, or can we create an environment where it's supportive and set up in a way that children are learning from the other children, clear expectations of, like you said, paraprofessional helper roles, when to support, when to back off, to let that independent initiation response kind of come out. And how do we go from there?
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I feel like all of this requires like a lot of adult restraint. Like I was like thinking as you were talking through some of these, you know, allowing those responsive interactions, not just being the one to like, oh, hey, no, this is how you open the bubbles, or this, you know, this is the way that we should use it. This is the way I envision the sensory table being used, that like, you know, we get so stuck in our own ideas, and kind of going back to that flexibility too, that it does require the adults, whether it's the teacher, the paraprofessionals, clinician, to kind of check themselves a little bit and allow the flexibility, but allow the responsiveness of the back and forth. Well, why did you think to put those in there? That's cool. Like those kind of responses.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why sometimes children kind of move away from adults when adults get into teach mode, if you call it that.
For sure.
You know, here's the train. Oh, what is it? What's it say? Put it on here. Push it. And it's like, that smells and looks like work to a child. They're not interested in that.
We just start asking questions. And I find myself guilty of this sometimes too. Like, you're like, what is the train? Where does the train go? What type of vehicle is it? And you're like, why did I just ask you six questions?
Yeah, because you want to get learning, right? You want to get that learning. You want to know that you're doing something. But holding that train out and slowly pushing it or pushing it faster and watching the child's reaction, those are bids. Those are communication bids back and forth. And they might not be overt or discreet, but that's still engagement that's happening on a social level. And thinking about that. So sometimes I'll see kids, they're my little flitters. They flit around from toy to toy and item to item or center to center. And when I watch them, what I find is as soon as they land on something, boom, an adult pounces on them. They're out of there because they're like, nope, gotta go. So just purposefully, intentionally thinking about how we can support the children to engage with something. I think we as adults, you know, we want purposeful play. We want appropriate play and playing with things in a certain way. And that's just not how children play or learn all of the time. Everyone's different and everyone's wired differently. So I think we need to respect their interest and how they play with things. And I really think getting professionals to think about play schemas is really important. So for example, the child who likes to spin around in a circle or spin things around, right? That might look like a self-stimulatory behavior. For some children that are developing play schemas, that's a rotational play schema. There's nothing wrong with it, right? They eventually grow out of it as they get language, they get engaged, their executive functioning, all that good stuff starts to develop. They go into higher levels of play. So I'm a huge supporter of looking at what are those different play schemas that look like stims, and are they really just underdeveloped play schemas? So the kids that like to pace and wander back and forth or push things around. I drop my son off at daycare. I look at the little baby toddlers. They're constantly pushing the cars and the wagons back and forth with no purpose outside other than to transport, which is a play schema. So I think when we can start to identify how children play with things, gosh, this could be a whole nother episode, play with things and how they learn, what is that reinforcing property or aspect about what they're doing? And that doesn't matter if it's play, if it's self-help, if it's learning in a group center. What makes it fun and meaningful is where you're going to get that learning to come out of it. And then eventually we start, you know, fading the supports. And as they get older, work and learning starts to look a little bit less fun. And then you become an adult and, you know.
No, that was a great example. And I love the concept of play schemas too. And thinking a little bit more critically beyond just like, oh, he likes trains. Let's like throw train things at him. Well, what is it about trains that he likes, or the trampoline, or, and thinking a little bit deeper. And I, obviously in a classroom with 22 kids, you can't think super critically too much about every child because you don't have time, but I think more observation in all classrooms can really give you so much valuable information like that about reinforcers, about interests, about, and that you can play off of.
Yeah. And I think I'm a big fan of putting visuals up to support staff and staff training. So I know, like in my clinic in Vegas, we had right by the front door when the kids came in, there was a big stop sign and it said, wait, so they could initiate. That's not a prompt for the children. That's a prompt for the adults. When we look at why children are not initiating, asking questions, or coming up with ideas, again, sit back and observe. They don't have a chance to do so. We're constantly one step ahead of them directing it.
Yeah.
That's not bad. But if we want this back and forth reciprocity where they're initiating, they're coming up with ideas to how they want to draw the letters, circle, paper, whatever. If we're not holding space and using these purposeful pauses to get them to do that, then how will they ever do that?
Yes. And all these little strategies are things that can so easily be embedded, I mean, really into any classroom, any age level.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, and I hear sometimes, well, if I put something in a clear container or put it up on a shelf, I'm restricting something, you know, and I think I'm not restricting access to the item. I view it as I am arranging the environment to contrive or create an opportunity for that child to initiate and to seek out and advocate for themselves. If they have free access to everything, there is no function or need for them to do that. I know there's a big thing sometimes about withholding reinforcers and withholding items. I think it's a concept. It's a framework of how you view what you're trying to do with it.
Yeah,
I'm trying to arrange the environment to really get myself face to face, to support the child, to really help them seek out people, ask for assistance, all of that good social pragmatic stuff that we want to have support with. If I don't have an environment set up to help with that, I can't support those skills and make sure that they master them and become proficient and then move on to the next level of skills.
Absolutely. And I think it mimics the real world. You know, in the real world, for me to access my reinforcers, I do have to engage in social behaviors. Like to get Starbucks, I have to walk into the Starbucks. I have to order my drink. I got to wait for my drink. Like there's things I have to engage in order to get what I want typically. And so I think that kind of mimics the typical schedule of reinforcement in the real world.
Absolutely. And I think about classrooms like positive behavior support or managing behaviors or supporting behaviors. You know, we talk a lot about regulation within NDBIs. And, you know, it's important, I think, to look at signs of dysregulation. What does it look like when a child starts to get dysregulated, a scale of like 0 to 5 before they go nuclear? You know, they might pivot and shift their body away from us. There are subtle cues, I think, like you said, if we sit back and observe, that we can start to pick up. Or circle time, if they don't get to sit on the particular square, that could be a trigger for them, right? How can we support them to stay regulated and work on that cognitive flexibility and get into those executive functioning skills? I think some of the stuff that you have done on this is great. And getting that information out to more and more classrooms to help them. Like if we could get executive functioning skills for a lot of these little ones, it solves a lot of these issues that we keep encountering. Yes. They don't have the prerequisite skills, the collateral skills are missing, but yet they need those executive functioning skills to manage and be successful in that classroom environment.
And I love how these strategies tie so nicely into that and that self-regulation piece, which I've been like on a deep dive on research on that over the last like 3 months, and it comes back to everything. You know what I mean? If you're not regulated, there's, you know, you're just at such a disadvantage and play such a role in our behaviors and academics and everything else. So I like how, you know, this idea of categorizing strategies under NDBIs is kind of combining all of these things that we know are important, but how do they work together?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, babies are born with the same range of emotions that we all have. They just don't get the skills until much later to start to cope with that. And if you, again, are by nature of some of the characteristics of who you are, just not as much socially attuned into the world around you, learning from others and watching others because of some social attention motivation differences, you miss out on how to self-regulate. Before we can self-regulate, we need to co-regulate, right? We need to learn how to do that well to get us to that level. And how do we do that? We need some support with that. And I think it's huge to be able to find out how we can advocate and support our little ones and to help them kind of, you know, they're little people with big emotions, right? Mm-hmm. And it's okay for them to have a bad day. It's okay for them to have a tantrum, right? We're just trying to kind of keep that pendulum within not hurting themselves and not hurting others and all that good stuff. And, you know, they're children. And I also like to talk about, you know, they might be 3 or 4 chronologically. Where are they at developmentally with emotional regulation, identifying emotional states, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not there. So kind of thinking about how we can support them. And I love when you say deep dive. I'm always deep diving down a rabbit hole, or I'm peeling back something. That's my other term I use. I'm going back to the basics of what are those prerequisite skills again? What does he need to do to self-regulate, to go back, to co-regulate, to figure out, does he even know what those feelings are? I think those are really important, especially because when you get into the classroom environment, you have this beautiful little petri dish, if you will, of mixed personalities and opinions and characteristics of all of the children, like a little melting pot of everything that's in there. And then how do you manage that, right? It's just like managing a workforce, like different people, different personalities, different strengths, different things that, you know, bother some people versus another. And I think teachers are amazing by nature of what they do to manage all of that. One-to-one is easy peasy. Putting it into a classroom environment takes a whole nother layer of skills to take all of that in. But I really think NDBIs are a good gateway for that because they are so good about getting everything kind of in line that's going to support that child and those strategies to have that supportive, inclusive learning environment that's going to maximize and promote social communication and academic development for, you know, kids with autism. I think there's a great way for them to really enhance what the teachers are already doing to make that learning a little bit easier, to support that regulation, which, you know, hopefully helps the whole flow of the classroom go a little bit more smoothly.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I feel like I could talk about this forever, and I'm sure you could as well. There's like probably 3 sub episodes we should do on
that.
But I know. Well, Jamie, thank you so much. This has been, I think, a great overview for people that this was new to, but also, you know, I love the in-depth kind of strategies and examples that you gave for people that are already familiar with this. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. This has been great.
Can you tell a little bit more where people can learn more from you? And actually, before you answer that, I just want to highlight that in the show notes, Jamie made some amazing visuals that give even more information that I love, and I will be linking those. But where can people go to learn more about NDBIs from you?
Yes, absolutely. So I have just launched an NDBI Essentials Professional Development Mentorship. So it's an online platform. It's called NDBI Essentials. And if you want, I can give you the link to share. And it's all about ESDM, NDBI, all this good stuff that's out there. So once a month, we have a free CEU. There are 10 to 12 downloadable resources to help you put into practice what you're learning, sometimes more, because I get excited to make these fun visuals. We have weekly office hours with myself. We have guest mentors that come in and talk with us, and then members-only events. So the whole premise of that is to come for the content and stay for the community is kind of the brainchild I had with it, to get people who are looking for mentors and want to implement this amazing practice with their children, their students, their learners, that you have a place to go to access those. And then I also have a bunch of online courses that are designed for professionals. And I can get you that link as well. That's just through the Sage Learning Systems, which is my company where I develop the courses and the products and all that good stuff to really disseminate NDBIs to get it out there. And so I am very grateful for this opportunity to chat more about this important topic.
Perfect. I will link all of that in the show notes. And again, thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you as well.
Thanks for listening to the Autism Helper podcast. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, hit subscribe. It would mean a lot to me if you left some feedback. Whether I'm working one-on-one with a student, doing a podcast like this one, or presenting for a PD, my goal is always to provide as much value as I can. So your feedback really helps me make sure I'm doing just that. If you have other topics you'd like me to cover, leave in the feedback or message me on social media. You can follow me at The Autism Helper on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Pinterest, or visit my website, theautismhelper.com. Thanks again for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Having the right resources for your classroom is essential to making sure your classroom is running smoothly. At the Autism Helper Shop, we have all of the resources you need to make sure you have the behavior, communication, and curriculum supports for your students. Within our shop, we have adapted books, task cards, resources aligned to the VBMAP and the ABLES, behavior plan flowcharts, data sheets, curriculum. Everything you need, whether you are an early childhood teacher or a high school teacher, we have all of the resources that will meet those students' needs. So head over to shop.theautismhelper.com to check out all of our resources.